Today on Against the Grain, the cowboy is a mythified character in American society, conjuring up rugged individualism and masculine brawn, values dear to American capitalism. But historian Mark Laws suggests that when we think of the cowboy, we should think of a precarious, and sometimes striking, wage worker. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak to him about labor, class struggle, and the cowboy. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The cowboy brings to mind so many of the things we don't like on the left, and which are valorized in American myth-making. But what if the image of the cowboy, and the West more broadly, as a stand-in for capitalism in American empire, are wrong? In The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West, published by Verso, Mark Laws argues that we need to see the cowboy as an exploited worker in a West marked by the consolidation of big capital, the extermination of the native population, and a state that often used the same armies to slaughter native peoples as to put down labor unrest. Laws is professor of history at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Cincinnati and the author of scores of books including Race and Radicalism in the Union Army. Mark, what place did the cowboy in fact play in the social order of late 19th century America?
There was a series some years back by Tony Robinson called The Worst Jobs in History on the BBC. If you had an American version of this, the cowboys would probably be the first episode in terms of the worst job. It was the very bottom of the class structure in some ways. They were migratory labor for the most part. They were overwhelmingly young, terribly underpaid. If you were working as a cowboy on a cattle drive, one of the big issues over wages, for example, is they're talking about maybe $30 a month, which is unbelievable considering that the workday was 12, 16 hours a day, and maybe part of the day on Sunday. They worked incredibly long hours for very little in terms of money, very little in terms of prospect. Of course, no job security. And when the entire job was over, they were hundreds of miles away from home in terms of the cattle drives. The better position among the cowboys would be to have a permanent job on a ranch, and that was something that only a fraction of them could actually were actually lucky enough to have. You need the most work to do this sort of thing if you're going to move those large herds. That's when you really get the larger number of people becoming cowboys. There was a tremendous amount of turnover, and that's one of the things that allows for a kind of mythologizing of the cowboy. The people who were actually doing this would be doing other jobs. They were farmhands. Some of the people that you encounter in the book, for example, were working on the railroads as well, or you might work as a miner or a prospector. And being a cowboy was what you did when you didn't really have anything else to do. My impression is that very few of these people, after the first cattle drive, were ready to go on another one.
So then the reality of the cowboy was as a wage worker whose work was pretty precarious. That contrasts quite strongly with the image of the cowboy as this representative of rugged individualism, almost the idea of this person who's independent and really not dependent on the larger social system. Why is the contrast so stark?
Well, there's a myth about the cowboy, and it's in some ways it's the epitome of the myth about the American worker, and that is that if you take a job, even a terrible job, you work hard at it, you know, you stay sober, keep your nose to the grindstone, and eventually you'll be able to pull yourself into the middle class. Cowboys probably had a better chance of doing that, but for a very, very small window of time. At a certain point, that opportunity fades very quickly. But in the early days, when they really began the cattle industry, before the beef bonanza really reached its peak in the later 70s and early 80s, you have a period of the open range. And the open range meant that you had a lot of horses, a lot of cattle that were unbranded and roaming around, mavericks, as they would call them. And if you were a cowboy, even if you were at the time working for someone else, you could grab an unbranded horse with some unbranded beef on the hoof and cart it off, if you had a place to put it, a little, you know, homestead off on the side, and eventually build yourself up a little herd. And as most circumstances like that, you can attain a kind of a middle-class status if you have property and can start running your own business. But it's never going to last. You'll be run out of business by the big ranchers very easily.
Well, let's talk about the wider world that the cowboy operated in. And when you said the 70s and 80s, you're talking about the 1870s and the 1880s.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could talk about how, in the late 19th century, how the West was not just won, as the expression goes, but as you argue in your book, was made and remade. Tell us that story of white settlement, native displacement, extermination.
Depending on where you look in the West, it could happen very quickly. That's one of the surprises I had when I started really looking into this. In American history, the sort of founding idea in American history was the Turner thesis. You know, Frederick Jackson Turner, 1893, the time of the World's Fair in Chicago, he delivers this incredibly influential paper called The Significance of the Frontier in American History. And he attributes to the frontier the development of democratic attitudes and rugged individualism, all of the sort of things that sort of become part of that mythology of the West. The last few decades, scholars have looked at this very differently. And while they see the West as playing a very important role in this entire process, the West is really a legacy of conquest. It's a legacy of ethnic cleansing. It's a legacy of a very rapid transformation of the environment. If we think of the 70s and the 80s nationally, it used to be known as the age of the robber barons, right? It's the Gilded Age. There's nothing to counter that in the West. If you go east, there are different kinds of sort of bourgeois interests that have to reconcile themselves, large landowners, railroad owners, manufacturers, mining, all sorts of things. In the West, these big companies can come out there and really gain a rather rapid control over everything. The large ranchers in parts of Texas, for example, or Kansas, or Wyoming, or Montana, anywhere in the plains, they can have an almost oligarchic control over what happens to people. They get this rather quickly. In the Texas Panhandle, where this strike occurs in 1883, for example, the native population is basically pushed out in a series of wars waged by the U.S. Army, assisted by Texas Rangers, in the 1870s. They're exterminating the buffalo at the time. They're also getting rid of the Indians, and they're going to replace them with longhorn cattle, domestic longhorn cattle, and a new human population as well. And all of that really happens so quickly. By the time you're in the early 1880s, some of these large ranchers, they have land the size of a county. They represent capital that comes from places like Chicago, New York, of course, but also London, Glasgow. This is sort of international capital coming into the West, because there was so much money to be made from beef at that point. The thing that changes this so quickly, to go back to the sort of national picture of the robber barons, the archetype, I guess, of the robber barons are the railroads, right? They're the great villains in the entire piece. Understandably, in some ways, as the railroad comes in, they change just about everything. Suddenly, you're not the homesteader off on your own little plot of ground somewhere, getting enough food to feed yourself and your family and maybe selling a little something in town for taxes and clothes, medical, whatever you might need in terms of the money economy. Now you are competing, if you're growing corn in Kansas, with people who are growing corn in Illinois or upstate New York. It's now creating, the railroads are creating a national market for these things. And it accelerates this process where the large concerns can swallow the small concerns. It's often said that there were more farmers in this period we're talking about someplace like South Dakota than there are today. And it's simply because the larger farms swallow the smaller ones. The development of technology in agriculture does that, but not just agriculture, of course, any of these industries we talk about. The three great industries that seem to dominate the West piecemeal, the railroads, of course, mining, which, depending on where you're looking at in the West, you've got copper, lead, gold, silver, have tremendous control. Virtually company towns are invented because of their power. And then you have this the situation in terms of the beef bonanza, the big cattle barons. This is really something that comes out of Texas, and it comes out of post-Civil War Texas. The Reconstruction in Texas is resolved, of course, violently. I don't want to say it's not resolved politically, because that is a way that you could politically resolve something, I suppose. But it's not resolved by the ballot. In Reconstruction in Texas, the Republicans that come to power after the Civil War basically are trying to change the way the state functions. And all of the old leaders of the state, all the old big money in the state, the law enforcement mechanism, they try to get rid of the Texas Rangers and replace it with the Texas State Police. These are going to be disproportionately African Americans, for example. And it's going to create an ongoing series of violent confrontations that take place in Texas. It's not an accident that the enforcers for this new hierarchic, this new oligarchy that's emerging in the West, are going to be hired guns from Texas. This is a place that they get their training.
So how then, mapping on to the picture you're painting for us of the changing political economy of the West, the concentration of capital, large ranches, the railroads and their expansion, mining, how does this then change the workforce? Who is the workforce? And what sort of conflicts start brewing of the kind you're just alluding to?
Well, it's very interesting, the workforce, isn't it? We were talking before, you know, about the creation of this new kind of hierarchy. It's also, of course, going to be a racial hierarchy, isn't it? And what happens in the restructuring of the economy is that certain groups are going to get marginalized, certain are going to be kept at the bottom, and some are going to be assimilated into strata within a working class. In the case of the cowboys, for example, most of these people are going to be, and I'm talking about the panhandle now, in East Texas, it seems like a majority of the cowboys are African Americans. In the valley, a majority of them tend to be Hispanic. When you go up into North Texas, you go up into the panhandle, the areas that are moving those large herds to the railheads in Kansas, the ones that are closest to that. Oh, these are going to be younger guys, younger white guys, who are in their early 20s, mid-20s. They're not old enough to have been in the Civil War. They were probably children. They may be the sons of veterans or whatever, but no real connection to the Old South. They're almost like the displaced persons of the Civil War. So they can sort of be, this is how they can fit into this whole process. If you have the Milton Friedman way of looking at sweatshops, he used to say, well, it's not really a sweatshop, it's how these people actually get to fit in and make money out of capitalism. You could say that same thing, I suppose, about the cowboys.
That's the voice of Mark Laws. He is the author of The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this period that you are talking about, the period of the robber barons, of the really rapid conquest of the West and transformation of it, is also a period of great social strife, of unrest, and then of great violence. Violence is a theme that runs throughout your book, The Great Cowboy Strike. Can you tell us broadly, before we focus on the cowboys themselves, about the kind of labor unrest that was taking place in the United States in the 1870s and 1880s?
Well, there were there were all sorts of labor organizations that were developing. The one that was the largest and probably the most important were the Knights of Labor, which was a secret order, reached about 750,000 in terms of membership. It was part of a number of these associations that were expressing the class tensions of that period. When I was conceiving this book, I was thinking of how I could talk about the question of class formation in relation to traditional Western themes like range wars, and also to the ignored dimension in terms of insurgent politics. Insurgent politics come out of these associations, and they're inseparable from labor struggle. We have the Patrons of Husbandry, which emerged in the 1870s in the upper Midwest, becomes incredibly large, several million members. You have the Industrial Brotherhood, which is sort of the godfather of the Knights of Labor, comes out of the Grange in southwest Missouri. The Industrial Brotherhood wanted to organize workers as well as farmers, and coming out of a southern state in the process of Reconstruction, they also wanted to organize blacks as well as whites. So the Industrial Brotherhood is often neglected in this. Later, you have the Farmers Alliance, another mass organization. But these aren't just sort of social orders. They have an agenda, even when they don't think of themselves as being overtly political. Their arguments, what they want to see happen in the society, are a range of essentially political demands. And the very fact that they form and they take root and they become so large, it's a good reflection of those sort of social tensions that exist in the West. You have everywhere in America, you have the old agrarian dream, right, where you think that you can move out of a big city, get your little farmstead in Nebraska, and become a successful small businessman, growing corn and being successful as a landowner. It really doesn't happen like that very often. But they don't give that up without a fight. And in a sense, from the 1870s through the 1890s, that struggle over what the future of the country will be, what the future of the West will be, is a struggle over the future of the country. Large business concerns, big businesses, whether we're talking about rail, mining, or even the cattle industry, they'll put a lot of money into these enterprises as long as they get a profit out of it. Once it's not profitable, they just go somewhere else. And so it's not as though these folks are actually investing in the development of the West. They're absolutely central to the development of the West, but for them it's simply a place they're making money out of at any point in time. So there's a tremendous ground for social organization, social discontent among farmers, among people, well, certainly among the groups that are sort of the outcast groups in all of this. We think of the situation of African Americans in Texas or Arkansas or Missouri, Native peoples, of course, Chicanos, Hispanics in the Southwest, later on the Chinese. All of these groups are going to play a very important role in terms of the West, and it's going to make the West, in some ways, it's going to make the West more characteristic, a more interesting place to look in terms of understanding race than the rest of the country, because you have all these different factors involved.
Well, tell us more about that and the degree to which, as people were struggling around the issues that were directly facing them, some of them were racial in nature, some of them were class, and some of them were a combination of the two. To what degree did the organizations that were springing up see the need to link arms across racial difference, and how much, to what degree were racial differences really sort of an insurmountable factor in creating broader solidarity?
It kind of depends on when and where. Most of the West had a real problem in terms of the Chinese, partly because the Chinese were brought over as contract labor early on, and they were generally from that point on seen as simply contract labor. They were people who were underwriting wages, and so it wasn't at all true. After a certain point, they're basically in the same mix with everyone else. What I found when I was looking at the cowboys And I think this is probably true of the American workforce in general in the 19th century and in places well into the 20th century and right up to the present in places, is that you basically have a workforce that's ethnically stratified. So the question of interracial solidarity or even interethnic solidarity often simply doesn't come up, even when it should come up. Different groups have control over different occupations, right? So, say, in this period, for example, there are reasons why the Irish are viewed as, you know, as the quintessential policeman is an Irishman, because the Irish were here at a time when the police forces were organizing. They were the base of the democratic machines, and giving them a job in the police department was would meet the need to consolidate their relationship to the machine, and at the same time, they would have control over that. Other places, furniture making in New York is going to be done by Germans at a certain point. And so, you know, that kind of process is sort of part and parcel of how you make an American workforce. And it happens in the West, too. There's that kind of ethnic stratification. Now, you get into some interesting problems when you're dealing with something like a new industry, like the cattle industry during the beef bonanza. The original signers of the call for the cowboy strike, 23 names, and two of them are Hispanic, and that kind of indicates indicates that there's some openness to the idea of solidarity beyond white workers. There are elements, there are cases when you're looking at the panhandle where you find blacks working in the industry, but they don't generally work as cowboys. They'll work as cooks. They'll, you know, work as kind of mid-management at times, but cowboy is a different matter, especially going out on the cattle drives. I think I found one instance where someone had done that, and I'm sure that people who do study, you know, the cattle drives a little more closely may have encountered this. But it doesn't look to me as though there was a great deal of mixing in that.
How did
The organizations, I said the Industrial Brotherhood and certainly the Knights of Labor, advocated solidarity. And how well they did or didn't do with that probably depended on where you look.
How did cowboys organize themselves when they had grievance? And was there a tradition of radical organizing amongst cowboys? Did it come from more spontaneous acts? What did you turn up?
The rumor was always that there were organizers. Whenever you have trouble, you blame secret organizers, right?
Sure.
There's talk of there being anarchist cowboys after Haymarket in Chicago, for example. I don't doubt that they had that anarchist newspapers, socialist newspapers, radical agrarian newspapers were being read by cowboys. And there may have been some connections here and there. But in terms of actual labor strife, cowboys had no real power except on those at the onset of a drive. Basically, the large ranchers, if you're going to try to get your herds together, get them organized, get the food together to support people on the road, get the workforce together and get them north, you're on a timetable that's kind of rigid. You have to start, if you get your cattle to the railhead late, when they've already been buying cattle, your price is going to be lower. And you can't start too early because the rivers will be flooding in the spring, right? So you have to get going at just about the right time. And this gives cowboys a period of a few days, a couple of weeks, where they actually have tremendous power because you're really off in the middle of nowhere. You don't have large towns. You don't have a workforce that you can, you know, hire to replace strikers or anything like that. You've got what you've got. And if they suddenly decide, as they did at times, where they're not going to cooperate, they're just not going to go on the cattle drive unless the following demands are met. And it usually has to do with wages. So the cowboys can then act, and if they act quickly, and if they stick together, they can win. The strike, the famous 1883 strike in Oldham County up in the Panhandle, this was one that the sort of call for the strike meetings signed by 23 people according to the other accounts, it grows, and depending on the time you're looking at it, it reaches to where you're talking about several hundred people involved. And that may not sound like much, but that's, you know, the majority of the adult male population in the county. So these strikes can become very, you know, they can take off. Once that happens, once you have that many people involved, the owners are going to give in. They will agree to anything in order to get their cattle on the road and meet that timetable. Now, the problem is, in terms of a permanent organization, that they will probably not hire back the ones that they view as troublemakers, right? So that you might get good pay this year, but next year it's going to be a totally different situation. There was at least one assembly listed in the Knights of Labor in Colorado, I think it was, that was to describe the composition of it as cowboys. And there certainly were cowboys who were connected with the radical, so-called Black International, or the Red International. There were cowboys associated with them. The most famous of them was probably Bronco John Sullivan. Bronco John was from Wyoming and went out on his own very early in life, wound up becoming a scout for some of these cattle drives in Texas. And he actually winds up doing his own Wild West show. So he's a rather interesting character. He winds up touring the East during the 1880s. It's not unusual, if you look at the old newspapers, that there's a Wild West show and you see that Bronco John is there. He might very well give an interview with the newspapers in which he's going to spout all sorts of Knights of Labor arguments. He meets, in Cincinnati, he meets Karl Marx's daughter and her husband, and I think Wilhelm Liebknecht was with them. The local German socialists took them down to a Wild West show when they were visiting Cincinnati, and here was Bronco John talking about capitalism to the 20 cowboys around the stage, who had just shown up, done their little show with their costumes, and then were sitting around griping about politics. So there were organizers. There were people who were playing an important role in all that. The thing is, in terms of most of the backdrop of all of this, of course, is that the labor in this period was subject to really severe repression in most places. If we think of something like the 1877 railroad strike, which reached into the West. This is in the wake of the panic of 1873. The railroads basically decided they would continue to pay dividends and so on, mostly by announcing pay cuts on non-management employees. So they did this and got away with it one year. Then they did it again, and they kept doing it. And it really forced the workers to respond in ways that they might not have ordinarily done. So in 1877, when this happens, and famously in the case of Martinsburg, West Virginia, the workers go home, get their Second Amendment devices, and come back to the railroad roundhouse, barricade themselves in, and put an end to the train traffic going through there that day. Once that happens in a few cities, it spreads up and down the line. And the way that the railroad owners dealt with this immediately is that they went to the government. They went to the city governments, went to the state governments. Ultimately, they went to the federal government. There was a famous case in Chicago in 1877 where the U.S. cavalry, coming back on freight cars from the West, still dusty from chasing the Sioux Indians. Remember, this is right after Custer, the Custer massacre the previous year. And they come back into Chicago, bring their horses off of these trains, mount up, and then they're attacking the immigrant crowds in Chicago. There's a great deal of violence in terms of the repression of labor discontent in this period. And the problem is that when the employers get to do what they want, they always want to do more. So even if they're successful, it's not as though they're stamping out labor discontent. It just means that they're going to be doing something even worse to create next year's labor discontent. So The Gilded Age is a period where there's a great deal of this sort of labor violence all around the country. In the West, it's different because basically these people have, as I was saying before, it's not a pluralistic ruling class that you have. They're very much controlled by rings, by political machines, by a few big industries or even a few big employers. If we take the case of Wyoming with the Stock Growers Association, they simply run the place. The same with Montana, where Teddy Roosevelt became famous as a rancher.
And it also sounds like, as you just illustrated, that the violence of conquest, of racial violence, then bleeds over into labor violence, violence against workers who might be white or they might be other races, and that, you know, that generalized violence from the state kind of linked up with capital is a hallmark of that era.
Yes, and I think, if we think about Texas as sort of the school for this sort of thing, when we talk about range wars, if you look up range wars, right, most of what you're going to be seeing, not all by any means, are, you know, very famous cases outside of Texas, but Texas seems to have them recurrent. And they're just going on almost continually. And this is a legacy of what happens after Reconstruction, where you basically got the struggle of the old white redeemer governments, the Democrats coming back into power after the Civil War, the old Confederate elite, it might be one way of thinking about them, they're coming back into power, and they're trying to crush out all the institutions that the Reconstruction had put in place. And part of that was the idea of having armed black law enforcement officials in the state. So, yes, the training ground for violence, when we talk about something like the Johnson County War, 1892 in Wyoming, this is where the Stock Growers Association is basically putting together a list of people they want to get rid of, and they're hiring gun thugs to come up and do this for them. And they are Texas-hired guns. The reason they're Texas-hired guns is that they are products of that conflict in Texas.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West. His name is Mark Laws. He's professor of history at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Cincinnati, and his many books include Free Labor, The Civil War, and The Making of the American Working Class. So tell us about the cowboy strike wave that took place in the mid-1880s. In 1883, there was the strike in the Texas Panhandle. What happened after that, and to what degree were the strikes connected?
I think it's hard to tell. The trouble with cowboy strikes is that they're taking place where there aren't a lot of big towns. There aren't a lot of big towns with newspapers. So you're sort of left to do a lot of reading between the lines. It's a great detective story, though. You're going to get, most of what you're going to get in the newspapers are going to be what the employers are telling the newspapers. The problem is they don't always tell them the same thing. So you get little glimpses, little windows into it. The 83 strike is usually seen as the first one. There's some indication that there was an earlier strike in Kansas, which may or may not have been the case. It's hard to say. But the 83 strike was certainly the first really big one. And it's often described as a tremendous failure in the newspapers. It was not. It was a sterling success. But it makes sense that if you're an employer, that you would want the story to go out that this was completely crushed and that all the men lost their jobs. And everybody was miserable, and the cattle walked themselves up from Texas to the railheads in Kansas. That's not what happened. There are a few counts that come through that talk about a successful strike, and I think it was almost surely a successful strike. I say that the people don't go on these cattle drives unless it's they don't really have any other options in terms of employment that season. But, of course, some of them that don't have options are going to come back. So people who show up in the Texas cattle drives, for example, they're going to show up all over the West. Some of them, at the end of the drive, they're up in Kansas. They may continue to another point in the West. They may go out to Colorado. They might go up to Wyoming. Wyoming, of course, is just full of Texans at this point. And that is because they were the people who really pioneered in terms of the beef bonanza. The beef bonanza comes to an end due to some really rough climate crises in the late 1880s. Had some very bad winters and blizzards that, 88, for example, you have a blizzard across much of North America. What happens in terms of the cattle industry was just a disaster. They put up fences, which means, of course, that if you have a really terrible winter, unlike the buffalo, the cattle can't migrate south because of the fences. So people lost a third to half of their herds in these terrible winters. They basically were making so much money out of raising cattle that they really overinvested, and they had too much cattle. They were overfeeding, overgrazing the land, and they just they were just going to have a problem with that at some point anyway. But what happened is in the late 80s is it created such a crisis that the big ranchers were all going out of business. And they had to make a decision at that point as to whether they, who was responsible for that, their own stupid business decisions or those overpaid cowboys. So what we wind up with in the late 80s with the fence cutter wars in Texas or into the 90s and something like the Johnson County wars, the large stock growers are essentially going after the small owners, going after their workforce, trying to employ the kind of social control in the West that they can get away with in the West, they really couldn't get away with quite as easily someplace like Homestead, Pennsylvania, or Pullman, Illinois, or anywhere in the East with newspapers and journalists. What happens in the West is that you have this wave of violent repression that accompanies the end of the beef bonanza. Now, the cowboys aren't in any position, I guess, as cowboys to respond to this, but you get some of these folks, some of these individuals that go off and they wind up getting jobs on the railroad, or they go into mining, or they do other things. And essentially, they sort of maintain their the lessons that they learned in that process. The one big strike you think of in this period in terms of the railroad was the Southwestern Strike. When you look at the Southwestern Strike, this is one that the Knights of Labor did in the 80s. When you're looking at the struggle around Fort Worth, for example, the newspaper descriptions of it, it's almost like a shoot 'em up scene from a cowboy movie. Both sides wound up armed, and they, you know, it was a losing battle in some ways. But the people who were involved in that strike, for example, or in the Johnson County War, were also taking those mass organizations with the political demands, and were taking their case into politics, taking their grievances, taking their demands into politics. So you have a wave of greenbackism, union labor parties, the populist party ultimately. Populist seems to be a bad word today. I don't know how that happened, but, you know, often words get misdescribed over time. The populists were the People's Party that advocated putting people before profits. The Socialist Party, when you get a Socialist Party in the United States, basically comes out of the populists. And the populists reflected those sort of broad concerns, lower middle class, laboring class, particularly of the West. And there are reasons why these insurgent parties were stronger in the West, because I think the social conflict was more intense there. Needless to say, we aren't talking about having those parties today, are we?
Indeed not. Which leads me to the next question, which is, why was there a waning of that political upsurge? Why did these various parties end up disappearing?
Well, there's sort of two ways of explaining it, right? The way that we're always told when the subject comes up, is we're told that the existing parties basically adopted what the third party movements wanted, right? That you know, the third party movements were advocating things like nationalization of basic industry, legislated shorter workday, women's suffrage, free and fair ballot, an end to the use of race to disenfranchise people in the South. And, of course, none of those things got adopted by the major parties. What happens is, in many cases, is the sort of violence that was used in these social conflicts, the violence that were used in the Range War, the violence used to deal with, you know, troublemakers among the cowboys or among the railroad workers, that same kind of violence is employed politically. These are not where they're really successful. These are not simply nominal third parties. They're not protest parties. They're not, you know, running a candidate here or there. They actually are based on these mass organizations. They have a large membership base, and they reflect the needs and concerns and aspirations of the membership. In many cases, in Texas, for example, where you have the Democrats as the overwhelmingly dominant party, in times the Republicans disappear in Texas. They are replaced by union labor or by the People's Party. And in Kansas, of course, famously in the 1890s, the Democrats are basically absorbed in the rising of the populace that then compete with the Republicans as a national party. So it's not as though we're dealing with marginal groups that are doing this. But in terms of how they are responded to, again, you know, there's a question of absolute direct violence. In the case of Arkansas, people who are congressmen are shut down. And we know who did it because their name's in the newspaper, and they were prominent local figures. They're not brought to trial. Nothing happens to them. Arkansas is one of those cases where you have a large population of African Americans that have come in, partly in response to repression elsewhere in the South. Arkansas is sort of something of a sanctuary, and they organized politically as part of this union labor coalition in the late 80s, and black leaders are basically disappearing in Arkansas. I'm sure that this is the sort of case where they were simply eliminated. Disappeared, as they would later use the term in parts of Latin America. In Kansas, even in Kansas, where you're dealing with people like Samuel N. Wood, who was an old abolitionist, a father of the Republican Party in Kansas, but also someone who was a stalwart ally of the farmers, a proponent of the shorter workday, a friend of the Knights of Labor, and so on. He was sued at one point, and he went to the court to have his hearing in front of the judge, and the judge's bodyguard shot him dead when he got out of the buggy. You know, again, we know who he was. He was an employee of the judge. Nobody's ever brought to trial for these things. Violence becomes something that's sort of accepted as a means of political enforcement, just as it had been accepted before as a means of enforcing the will in terms of range wars or in terms of labor disputes. And I would argue that the West in that sense is pioneering things. We go back to Turner's idea of the importance of the frontier in American history, the importance of the settlement of the West in the shaping of the American character. You can really look at a lot of this and see some forebodings of what can happen in terms of the 20th century.
Mark Laws, in terms of the 20th century and the way that the late 19th century, the conquest of the West, the figure of the cowboy, all of these are remembered is very frequently through Hollywood films. In fact, there's a whole genre. What does film and Westerns tell us or not tell us about the real history of cowboys and the history of labor unrest in the American West?
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think you think of something like the Johnson County War in 1892. I think of Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Gate supposedly killed the Western the genre, didn't it? Somehow they kill the Western genre every so often, and it somehow just doesn't quite die on us. But Heaven's Gate was about the Johnson County War. And when you see these dramatic shootouts and so on, and they're, you know, intended to be the sort of elements of the movie that are historically accurate. The killing of Nate Champion, for example, at the Casey Ranch. As near as we know, and the fellow going by in the buckboard in the movie is Oscar Flagg. Oscar Flagg and Nate Champion were leaders of the cowboy strike back in 1886 in Wyoming. So this is a long-standing conflict, a long-standing tension that goes back beyond, you know, 1892. This is sort of the most famous range war in the history of the West, has its origins in a labor conflict a few years earlier. The movies usually don't depict that.
Westerns are interesting because, of course, they're about the figure of the cowboy. They're also obviously about the mythology of the United States itself and creation myths. You know, obviously, films are often as much about the present as about the past or a vision of the present. How do you see the West as a stand-in, a particular version of the West as presented in films and within a larger mythology as a stand-in for the United States?
It's interesting to think about how they deal with race in Westerns. On one level, if you see like a remake of something like The Magnificent Seven, that's fabulous. I got a great kick out of that movie. I loved where the villain, who's the great robber baron, right, is talking about how you people will not be remembered. I will be remembered. I mean, those are some really interesting sorts of insights. And yet, in the middle of all of that, there is a complete fictionalization of how the West would have worked. We still are clinging to the mythology, even when we're trying to sort of explore important questions. If we could change the way race worked in the West by making movies in which people are treated as equals, that basically prolongs the mythology on one level. On the other hand, television series like Deadwood, I thought was absolutely fascinating. It annoyed me, but I wound up getting drawn into it, in part because of the importance of women in these communities. These are overwhelmingly male societies, and that gave women an incredible amount of power, and they used it. If you think about the development of women's suffrage, when it actually gets something that is put on the ground, something that becomes practical, it's the West that pioneers women's suffrage. You know, places like Wyoming. And that is an element in terms of how it's depicted frequently today that I think is quite interesting.
Well, let me end by asking you about the role of nature in this whole mythology. You mentioned Turner earlier on, this idea of the frontier. And one of the ways that the West, and to some degree the cowboy as well, are remembered or misremembered today has to do with the marketing of things like SUVs that are supposed to represent the spirit of America and the great frontier of the West. What is the role of nature in all of this when you think back to the really violent transformation of the West in the 19th century and how it's seen from the vantage point of today?
And nature is being conquered, right? Nature is subjugated. This was, of course, the great idea of the 19th century, the great idea of the Gilded Age and the age of the robber barons and the Industrial Revolution, that they were subjugating nature to human will. And, of course, at least the will of some humans. But at the same time, you do get a response to that. If we think about the environmental movement and we think about the ways people had responded to that ruthlessness in terms of nature, there were some brilliant pioneering thinkers in all of this. I mean, John Muir, in a sense, is going to be coming out of the West. California, we think of them in terms of California, but was very well aware of what was happening to nature everywhere. Or if we think of the great founding thinker of the environmental movement, George Perkins Marsh, Man and Nature, going back to the earliest period of the Republican Party when it was, you know, a people's party, a popular party. Marsh, who was Lincoln's emissary to the Italian states, on his travels, would go to the Levant, would go to the Middle East, and he came back and he was writing about the impact of ancient peoples on nature, the deforestation of the Middle East, and how that changed the climate. And, you know, he was talking about the human impact on the climate generations before we had the parade of people today who regularly talk about humans not having an impact, can't have an impact on the climate. The West gave us some real opportunities to do things. And I think that the end result is always going to be mixed. I just saw that the president was getting rid of a lot of acreage of national monument land, turning it over to business uses. But it was set aside at an earlier point for, based on an understanding and a realization of people coming out of the 19th century.
And much more that could be talked about to do with that, and also the history of the displacement of the Native Americans within that larger picture. Unfortunately, we're totally out of time. I've been speaking with historian Mark Laws. He is the author of The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is also the author of Race and Radicalism in the Union Army. And his forthcoming book is titled Long Road to Harper's Ferry, The Rise of the First American Left. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.